This is Where We Live. I'm Ray Hardman, in for John Dankosky.
Why are you here today?
I'm here to support the symphony. I'm a member of the symphony. I've been here, member of the symphony for 35 years, and our existence is in danger.
Our highest paid orchestra members are currently paid $23,000 a year, and their pay is going to be cut if these cuts go through to less than $15,000 a year.
It means people will have to be looking at doing more of the other things and less of the Hartford Symphony in order to balance this patchwork of jobs that we do. And if the symphony is taking away 40% of what they used to guarantee, then people are going to have to be going elsewhere.
Without a dedicated president, CEO, who understands the orchestra industry, I think we're at a very, very difficult situation.
Those are some of the voices of HSO musicians rallying in front of the Bushnell last month. Indeed, under the terms of the proposed contract, core members of the orchestra would see their salary drop from about $23,000 a year to below $15,000 a year. Musicians would also be required to be available for daytime rehearsals and performances, which they say would interfere with their daytime jobs and other obligations. The HSO musicians, who are represented by the American Federation of Musicians, Local 400, are looking for a better deal, and the contract negotiations seem to be at an impasse. Last year, the HSO entered into a management services contract with the Bushnell. The HSO pays the Bushnell for this service, which means the president and CEO of the Bushnell, David Fay, is also the president of the HSO. Many had hoped the partnership would secure HSO finances and see the cut in performances and pay for musicians as an indication that the Bushnell collaboration is not working. Coming up on Where We Live, a look at the contract and how other symphony orchestras have dealt with similar situations. We'll also talk about how symphony orchestras survive in this atmosphere of dwindling ticket sales and higher operating costs. Later in the hour, we'll talk with some HSO musicians who talks about what it takes to patch together a living playing music. And, of course, we'll take your calls. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. And just so you know, we did invite Bushnell and HSO President and CEO David Fay. We also invited HSO Director of Artistic Operations Steve Collins, the incoming HSO Board President Jeff Verney, and other board members to participate in today's program. They all declined. David Fay did provide a written statement for this show, and I'll read that right now. The Hartford Symphony has been in the process of transforming its organization into a modern, financially secure orchestra that is providing programming to our patrons that they desire. Our musicians are professionals dedicated to their art, and we are hopeful to reach a new agreement with them that gives the organization the flexibility needed to fully implement the tenets of the new strategic framework adopted by our board of directors this past June, while allowing our musicians to do what they do best, perform. We're very optimistic about the future of the HSO and the musicians helping us bring it to its full potential. Joining me now in the studio, three musicians from the HSO. Michael Pollard, he's a violinist with the HSO. He's a musician member of the HSO board and a member of the contract negotiating committee. Michael, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Ray.
Oboist Stephen Wade is here as well. Thank you for being here, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
And violist Ann Drinan. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Ray.
Michael, the HSO, first I want to get a reaction from you to that statement from David Fay. Is there anything new in that statement that gives you hope?
Not really. David Fay has said that we can't cut our way to success, and we would agree with that. In particular, you can't cut the very product you're selling. I think it should be noted that Mr. Fay comes from a nonprofit organization, the Bushnell, but they are dealing heavily in commercial work. They're presenters, and the Hartford Symphony are producers, and there's a big difference there. You know, we can do all the Broadway shows we want. The only thing that you're going to get out of that is ticket sales. We need to concentrate on the core of what a symphony is, and that's presenting classical music. Those are the people, the people that go to classical music concerts. Those are the people that donate beyond their ticket prices. So that's key. That's crucial.
Yeah. HSO management, they've really circled their wagons, as you've said, Michael. They say management and musicians agreed not to talk to the public about the contract back in January, and that they're the ones that are sticking to it. They've also accused the musicians of kind of reneging on that agreement back in January. First, was there an agreement to not talk to the press about ongoing negotiations with the contract?
Well, there's some discrepancy in terms of that. Certainly things had changed dramatically since that January 1st meeting. We have since entered into negotiations with Nathan Kahn, who is a national negotiator for the American Federation of Musicians. We went to the table and said we will agree to a 24-hour notice, but management has refused that offer. Mm-hmm. So here we are.
Mm-hmm. I have a previous statement by David Fay in which he says, we are preparing, and this was after musicians started talking to the press after the rally. He says, quote, we are preparing to respond factually to the accusations being made by the American Federation of Musicians in regard to the ongoing negotiations. And to any of you, I'd like a response to that. I mean, are the union reps, are the musicians being disingenuous? Are they giving out false information?
To the contrary, we believe that everything that we're presented is fact-based, and the actual presentation by the management as to the deficit has been manufactured. They actually put a line item in the budget saying that services that they did not sell cost the organization $400,000. They did not sell those services that had been sold in the past. To put them in the budget as a deficit item is truly ingenuous.
Case in point is that the core players, and if you wish, I can briefly explain the different tiers of the orchestra, but the core players for the last 20 years have been divided into seven ensembles that go into the school systems and play 30 performances, 30 services within the school system. This past year, many of those seven ensembles did 3, 4, or 5. We've had no trouble selling them for the last 19 years, and all of a sudden this past season, it seems that all those opportunities for us to perform dried up, which is very strange.
Yeah, and if I can amplify on that a bit, services that were scheduled, that were in the contract, a chamber orchestra series, a jazz and strings series, those were written off. Those were
X'd
from the they were canceled, and that also contributed to the false numbers that are put in the budget.
That's a little troubling because not only are you, cutting the salary of musicians, you're not having as many guaranteed services, but you're also pulling away from outreach, which, we're going to learn a little bit later in the show, is so important to the viability of a symphony orchestra, especially when you're talking about cultivating new listeners and new audiences.
It's critical.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, Ray. I watch in the children's concerts that I do in any a huge swing in demographics from, very wealthy towns to very, very poor ones, total engagement on the part of all the kids. The teachers are great with us. The impact of our appearances on these little lives is just impossible to underestimate. You just can't measure that.
Mm-hmm. There's also a pay freeze for each individual appearance?
Yes.
There has been for quite some time.
Okay. The service rate has been frozen for the past 3 years, and management's latest proposal is for an additional 3-year freeze.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people can relate to that, going 6 years without any type of raise whatsoever. You can imagine these cuts for up to 40%, the impact they have on families and individuals. I think everybody can understand that.
Well, right now I'd like to bring into the conversation Anne Majette. She's the classical music critic for – the chief classical music critic for The Washington Post. Hi, Anne. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
Does any of what you've heard so far surprise you?
Alas, no. I mean, I suppose the details are different in every case, and there's an adage that every orchestra is an individual story. But it is a very difficult time for orchestras now, and there have been a number of painful stories of this nature around the country in recent years.
And we're talking about some of the storied orchestras in America.
Yeah, the Minnesota Orchestra had a painful 18-month lockout. People wondered if that was going to end the orchestra over a large pay cut to the musicians. Atlanta's had a couple of lockouts. The Baltimore Symphony musicians took two voluntary pay cuts and have almost, I think, restored them now over the years. The pay cuts did help the orchestra to build back up, so I suppose that's a positive counter story in that management did not impose those cuts totally against the will of the players, although nobody is happy to take a pay cut. But it's a difficult time for large classical music institutions. I always say classical music is fine. There is no danger of the death of classical music. But some of the bigger institutions that have traditionally propagated it for the last several decades are having to rethink their business models or rethink the way they've traditionally done things, and that is a painful and challenging process.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of these ways that, orchestras were able to thrive just simply don't work anymore. Let's talk about some of those, Anne, and let's start with subscription series.
Well, subscriptions are pretty well accepted to be a model of the past now. And for a long time in the 70s and 80s, the mantra was butts in seats, because the subscription series allows you to know how many people are coming and therefore to plot your revenue. But in today's world, it's very difficult for families of any age to commit to every Thursday night at the symphony. I know that the New York Philharmonic has had to work much, much harder to sell each ticket. They're selling about the same number of tickets, but they're working much harder to do it, and they're selling those tickets to more people, which is to say that a family is less likely now to go 12 times a year. They may go two or three times a year. And while in that sense you're reaching more people and maybe it's good, it's very hard for an orchestra that's used to sort of saying, okay, we're going to have this many people, to figure out how to budget or plan when you don't know how many people are coming in. And people also don't want the same kinds of subscription series. People are piecing together different kinds of performances. There seems to be an appetite for more variety.
And when you kind of tailor make those different subscription series, that also costs the orchestra more money.
It does cost the orchestra more money, yes. Yeah. Yes. Now, one thing that's useful to think about is the evolution of orchestras. It has not been the case that for the last 100 years American orchestras have blithely offered their musicians full-time employment and suddenly are not. The full-time employment, of course, in the Hartford Symphony, it's not full-time employment, but the idea of a full-time year-round orchestra is a relatively recent historical phenomenon in this country. And as late as the 50s and 60s, musicians in large orchestras like the National Symphony routinely had other jobs on the side, and that was a piece of a freelance career. So in that sense, the Hartford Symphony, which already has that model, is not something new or pressed by the times. The issue was that in the 70s and 80s there was a lot of money, and it seemed like people could afford to play full-time in a symphony orchestra, and the question is whether the market will bear that now. And I say that dispassionately, apart from my personal preference, which would of course be to have lots of full-time symphony orchestras, but that may not be a model that's sustainable in the future on the same scale as it has been for the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, and real quickly, I want to go back to the HSO. In these situations where a symphony orchestra finds themselves in some financial trouble, they almost always go to the musicians for concessions. The 40% is being asked of the HSO musicians. Is that too steep in comparison with other symphony orchestras?
It's a lot. It's a lot. And I can't speak to what management has in mind, but I would assume the first offer was, I would assume that people would think there'd be some room to negotiate downwards from that. But yes, a 40% pay cut is drastic in any environment. I don't have the figures at my fingertips, but the Minnesota Orchestra's former president could cite the kinds of pay cut concessions that other orchestras had gotten, and they were certainly in the neighborhood of 20%. And I suppose it's a question of percentages, too, if you're talking about $100,000 a year or $23,000 a year. Although it doesn't much matter, a 40% pay cut is a grave difference in your income.
Yeah. Michael Pollard, has the HSO come back with something, a counteroffer yet?
Well, no, they have not. But I'd like to address something that Ann mentioned, which is ticket sales. Ticket sales only provide a fraction of a symphony orchestra's budget. And our financial difficulties are from a different issue, and that's a lack of an endowment drive. The board actually acknowledged in the latest strategic plan that the HSO, with its minimal endowment, is severely undercapitalized. And yet, they have not undertaken an endowment drive in nearly 20 years. Back in 2007, they paid for industry expert Tom Morris, which I'm sure most of our listeners or many of our listeners will know of. They hired him to help the symphony out of its financial mess. Even though Mr. Morris said that the musicians' contract was not the problem, the musicians, in a show of good faith, agreed to over $300,000 in concessions. And also essential to that plan was that the board was to undertake a $10 million endowment drive. This never happened. Now, with the formation of the alliance with the Bushnell, a main selling point of the alliance was the Bushnell's fundraising prowess. In April of 2014, a joint task force pledged to a 90-day fundraising goal of $5 million to help stabilize the organization and an additional goal of $10 to $12 million over the next 12 months. That's well over a year and a half. Today, there's approximately $3.3 million pledged and less than $400,000 in hand. So what we have is a string of broken promises and a habitual lack of follow-through in the organization, mm-hmm. and that's very troubling.
And Majette, I want to go back to you now. The National Symphony Orchestra is part of the Kennedy Center, is that right?
Yes, it is.
Is this a similar situation to the HSO and the Bushnell?
No, not at all. The National Symphony Orchestra is kind of sui generis in that the Kennedy Center will always catch it. I mean, there are many orchestras that are involved with the organizations where they play or where they perform.
Right.
But the Kennedy Center, due to its funding structure, has, I think, deeper pockets or a larger willingness to bail the NSO out repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case with every – I mean, the Atlanta Symphony also has it's an umbrella organization with its presenter. I wouldn't say that it's comparable now.
Right. We're talking about the future of the Hartford Symphony, the situation at the Hartford Symphony Orchestra with Ann Majette. She is the chief classical music critic for The Washington Post. We're also talking with three HSO musicians. Ann, you have three buzzwords for the modern orchestra: community, contemporary music, and cost cutting. Let's talk about community first.
Well, orchestras are having to really redefine themselves and think about what their role is in the community in a way that they're also not used to having to do traditionally. The idea that a symphony orchestra is an ornament to the community is kind of received wisdom, but I think there's a question today more of what does it do for the community? And just playing great concerts of great music, that's a supreme goal. But orchestras are finding that in order to develop an identity within the community, it's necessary to do more different kinds of performance, more kinds of outreach to raise awareness, simply because classical music does not have the same gravitational pull as it did 30 years ago. That's a simple fact, and that's not going to be overturned. It's not simply an ill because children aren't learning about it in school. It's a larger societal shift, and I don't think there's much use in wringing one's hands about it, but it is a fact that orchestras have to be a little more lively and innovative in order to get out in the community, which is not a terrible thing. A lot of orchestras have had some really great results by being more, quote, community-minded.
Mm-hmm. What about contemporary music?
Well, contemporary music is a tricky issue because a lot of an orchestra's core audience really wants to go hear the core canon. And yet, without playing contemporary music, an orchestra is definitely branding itself as a creature of the past, which some people feel it should be. It's sometimes compared to a multiplex where people go wanting blockbuster films, but then have to sit through a certain number of art films each year as well. So how to present this work and how to make it part of your organization's identity is a tricky question. That said, a lot of organizations are doing it excitingly, and there are ways with the kinds of smaller ensembles that the Hartford Symphony evidently has, and different kinds of designated series. I think that's one of the best ways to approach the contemporary music conundrum. Makes it sound like a problem, but the question of how to present more of it and how to get your audiences more excited. But there are lots of different ways to approach it. You have to have somebody who really wants to do it and cares about it, rather than thinking of it as sort of your spinach that you must present as part of a healthy meal.
Right. Stephen Wade.
Yes, I just wanted to piggyback on something Anne was saying, that there's more than one community that we're talking about. You know, the effects of an orchestra on a region or a city are really an amazing thing. Here in Connecticut, we have just poured money into UConn and made enormous efforts to, you know, to retain a serious tax base, to retain the talent in the state. You know, when you talk about the effects of the arts in general and an orchestra in particular on a region, especially on a regional basis where, you know, we're not talking about Boston, Philadelphia, or New York. We're talking about regional orchestras like, you know, Hartford and, you know, like size communities.
Memphis, Grand Rapids.
Exactly. The success stories in this way are numerous. And if you look at the resources, you know, for instance, the Americans for the Arts put together, you know, that you can find success stories all across the country, and I don't see any reason why we can't have that kind of success story here.
Yeah, Ann, you want to respond to that?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear a word of what he said.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay. No, and Ann, with just a few moments left with you, I would imagine, you know, these long, drawn-out contract negotiations makes the situation worse when it comes to major donors and givers. I mean, these are people who believe in the symphony, believe in the mission of the symphony, and I wonder, you know, how much these drawn-out contract negotiations kind of erodes that.
I think it's a very problematic issue because I think people want to give to something that they perceive as exciting. That doesn't mean something that's artificially bolstered up with an ain't classical music grand philosophy, but it does mean an idea that there's a vision and purpose moving forward. And, of course, it grieves music lovers to see a beloved organization divided. And I think that is a problem. And I think, again, it takes leadership and vision to get people sort of pulling in the same direction. But this is a problem with all labor disputes. If there were a magic bullet, everybody would be happy about that.
Right. Anne Majet, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Anne Majet is chief classical music critic for The Washington Post. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk with the HSO musicians who are joining me this morning about the contract and how they managed to do this patchwork of jobs to make a living. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266, comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll be right back. This is Where We Live. I'm Ray Hardman, sitting in for John Dankosky. We're talking about the Hartford Symphony Orchestra today. A contract proposal from HSO management would cut pay for core members of the orchestra from about $23,000 a year to less than $15,000. Musicians would also have to make themselves available for daytime performances. This could be a serious burden for musicians with day jobs. Joining me now are the orchestra members. We have violist Ann Drynan here, assistant principal oboist Stephen Wade, and violinist Michael Pollard. Again, welcome, guys. And let's just talk a little bit about your lives and how you kind of have to kind of cull this all together. I want to start with you, Stephen. First, where'd you go to school? Where'd you study?
I studied at the University of Lowell in Massachusetts for my undergraduate degree and the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston.
Mm-hmm. So you came out of school and started looking for work.
I did, yes. I played, that summer I got done with graduate school. I was a doubler. I worked in music theaters from about 1978 through that time. And when I got finished with school, I did some summer stock traveling. I did some tours, bus and truck tours. And I had been working on the oboe through graduate school, oboe performance degree. And I arrived home, I think it was in August, with my gigs at the end and my checking account at the same end. And then I took an audition and won it for the United States Coast Guard Band located in New London, which was just a fantastic job. And a shout out to my friends in that group. They are a magnificent group, and I enjoyed that a lot. And I worked as an active duty member of the Coast Guard for 30 years.
So now you're with the HSO.
I am.
Obviously, it's not your only source of income.
No, actually, right. I started with the HSO in 1996, and a few years later, I started teaching as an adjunct professor at Westfield State University in Massachusetts.
Great. Let's bring Ann in, and because you have an interesting story, you kind of came to the viola not in the typical conservatory way.
Well, my story is totally bizarre in that when I was 19 years old, I had a polio-type paralysis of my left wrist. Mm. And I had always planned to be a music major, began to, at that point, think I would never be able to do so. So I graduated with a BA in music from the University of Wisconsin. I went to Yale and have a master's in international relations and was planning to move to Washington when somebody mentioned Sam Kissel, who taught Dunis Method, which was designed by an MD, and I, at the tender age of 27, relearned how to play the viola.
Wow.
So in 1980, I won the position in the Hartford Symphony, and it's really one of the very happiest days of my life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very unusual, though, in that I have always had other careers.
Yeah.
I was worked for an artificial intelligence company, was a tech writer. I'm currently executive director of Concora, the professional chorus here in the Hartford area. And I work for a website, polyphonic.org, at the Eastman School of Music. But my colleagues are, most of them have day jobs. Many of them are public school teachers, or they are on the faculty of area colleges, or they have a private studio in their houses, which is why they have kept the core musicians have kept the mornings available for these in-school performances, but they need to have the afternoons available for them to teach either at an institution or in their private studios. And many people, if they're public school teachers or have a corporate job, are simply not available during the day, which is why there's a restriction on full orchestra rehearsals and not till 6:30 in the evening.
So presumably, if this goes through, they would have to take up...
They'd have to quit.
Or take vacation days, or something like that.
Demand for that 66... People must perform 66% of the services offered, or they will be potentially let go.
Yeah. That seems really restrictive, Michael.
Oh, absolutely. You know, every one of us has charted their own course through this music career. None of us went into music to make money. We went in because it's our core. It's why we do what we do. You know, myself, I started as a violinist in the orchestra, soon became the personnel manager for 25 years. That allowed me to do the afternoon work at home, raising three boys while my wife had the day job. She would come home. I'd say, goodbye, dear. The boys are yours. And I'd do my symphony work at night. So now I do not do the personnel manager job anymore, of which I'm very grateful. But I try to piece together as many performing jobs as I can. I'll sub with Springfield Symphony, New Haven Symphony, Orchestra New England, Foxwoods Casino if they want me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's everybody, like I say, everybody has to find their own way.
Yeah. Stephen Wade, is it safe to say that the HSO is one of your main gigs and something that they get first choice of when things happen? You work your schedule around the HSO work schedule. Is that right?
Yes, that is true at this point. Up until 2012, however, I was still active duty military. So I had to miss a lot of things for the HSO with when my duties in the military were coming first. And it got really kind of crazy when I started teaching at the college. I was actually working three jobs and driving Oh, well, I don't really even know. I retired my Prius last year with the 353,000 miles on it. So that stretch of time was relatively insane, but actually kind of thrilling in its own way. And at the moment, the Hartford Symphony is, as an artistic experience, it's what I'm all about. I work with incredible people there.
Mm-hmm. Real quick. You know, we're talking about for the core members, and you all are core members.
I'm a basic member.
You're a basic member. 23,000 dropped down to 15,000. What does $1,000 a month less in pay mean? I mean, not just for you, but for other orchestra members that you've talked to.
Think of yourself going to the bank to ask for a loan for a mortgage. If you can put a contract from the symphony there stating that you'll be paid 23,000 and possibly more. That's $23,000 towards whatever amount the bank is looking for to give you that mortgage loan. And if it suddenly is $15,000, that's a significant difference.
Yeah, yeah. Anybody else want to share, Michael?
Well, I worry about the young people coming into the orchestra. I've been in the orchestra 40 years, and I'm not negotiating this contract from a personal standpoint. I'm here because of my colleagues, my young colleagues especially, and the profession. It's frustrated me many years when people say, well, what do you do for a living? I play the violin. Well, no, I work very hard at the violin. And people spent a lot of money going through school. Instruments are very expensive. You have these loans to pay. You need the upkeep of the instrument. So it's difficult.
Yeah. Just a second, Steve. Anne, I want to just clarify a little bit. Core members, basic members, maybe you can tell us about this tiered system
at
the HSO.
I practice very quickly. The core is a chamber orchestra of 33 players, a small string ensemble, double winds, a few brass, one percussion. Add 23 players and you have the basic orchestra. Add a few more string players and the rest of the brass and percussion. And this is the orchestra that plays the Pops concerts, that plays – we used to do the opera. We do the Discovery. Add 23 string players and potentially 7 – we call them right of first refusal players. And you have the full orchestra. Mm-hmm. The right of first refusal are the third winds, the harp, the keyboard. They're hired when their instrument is required. So altogether, it's a – if we were at full complement, there are a few openings in the string sections, we'd be at 86 contracted players. So core, basic, and full.
Thanks, Anne. And Stephen, you had a point.
Yes, something Michael said rang a bell with me. You know, the reason that I'm negotiating this contract is, it's personal in a way, but in a way it's really about the long-term future of the orchestra. You know, Hartford deserves an orchestra for many, many years to come. And this is what, this is our first contract with the new management, and this is why we're being so painstaking about it. We really are about, preserving the institution for the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I may, Steve, it took 71 years to build the HSO, and this management proposal will dismantle the HSO in short order, guaranteed. As one musician posted on Facebook, you can cross Hartford off your audition list.
Mm. I was on the committee back in the mid-1980s that created the core, and the reason we did this was across the country, smaller regional orchestras were doing this, where some number of 20, 25, 30 players were offered more work, and suddenly you had an artistic cohesion. You had a chamber orchestra. You had people playing together much more frequently than the part-time, nighttime orchestra we'd been before. And as a member for 36 years, I have noticed a really profound improvement drastically, I would say, in the artistic quality of this orchestra. And now we attract people, regular members from New York City, from Boston, from Rhode Island. It's astonishing how far people will drive to make a very small salary because the orchestra is so excellent.
You're listening to Where We Live. I'm Ray Hardman, sitting in for John Dankosky today, and we're talking about the Hartford Symphony Orchestra. Let's take a phone call. This is Kurt from Woodstock. Kurt, welcome to Where We Live.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you got for us today?
Well, I used to work as a cellist, and during the mid-80s, I played with the Sacramento Symphony Orchestra in California.
Heavens.
And that was also a regional orchestra, I imagine about the same size as Hartford is today. They had a similar setup with the core and the full orchestra. I was at one point the principal cellist and also obviously a member of the core orchestra. And in the summer of 1985, I volunteered to be on the negotiating committee for symphony contract negotiations. And we spent the whole summer doing it. It was a long, hard slog trying to figure out something that both sides could live with every day in that room, you know, back and forth over the table. And finally, towards the end of the summer, we figured something that nobody figured out, hammered out something that nobody was particularly happy with, but was acceptable to all parties. And so we started playing the new season, and about 2 months into the new season, we all of a sudden got this message from management saying that, look, if you don't open up the contract again, we're just going to go belly up. And that was a shock to me, because I had just, I mean, naive as I was, I guess, I assumed that management was bargaining in good faith, but apparently they weren't, because, you know, something like that can't be new news. You know, it can't be something that's unexpected to them. So I just hope that the Hartford Symphony negotiating committee, the musicians, has it in the back of their mind that they have to take a good look at the numbers and make sure that whatever they negotiate is feasible given the current economic status of the business part of the organization.
All right, Kurt, good advice. Thank you so much. How is the Sacramento Symphony doing now?
Well, it doesn't really exist anymore.
They folded.
And they
was it right after that?
Yeah, I believe so. I wasn't there anymore at that point. I left, you know. I think they started a new, much, much smaller set of a community-type orchestra now that only has a few orchestras, a few concerts a year. But anyway, that's just kind of a warning, and hopefully things will work out much better in Hartford than they did in Sacramento. Thanks for taking my call.
All right, Kurt, thank you so much.
I was the ROPA delegate from Hartford back there. ROPA is a national organization, and the Sacramento story was just tragic. I remember the ROPA delegates from Sacramento giving this story, and they had everybody in the room in tears. It was really a breach of faith, I think, on the part of their management back then, and yes, indeed, they folded.
So Sacramento, a capital city, does not have a symphony orchestra?
They probably have a smaller version of that now, with, I'm sure, a different board.
Yeah.
I don't have the details at my fingertips.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break here. Coming up in our last segment, we'll take a look at the future of the symphony orchestra and formulas that seem to work for successful symphony orchestras. You can join the conversation 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll be right back. This is Where We Live. I'm Ray Hardman, sitting in for John Dankosky. We're talking about the future of the Hartford Symphony Orchestra today. Management is cutting back on the number of performances next year, and core musicians will feel the effects. The proposed contract cuts their pay by about 40%. We learned earlier in the program that's a common problem, even among the best-known symphony orchestras. Many are learning and finding their way in this new world of dwindling revenues and increased expenses. Joining me now is Polly Kahn. She's the principal of PK Art Solutions, PK Orchestra Solutions. Polly, welcome to Where We Live.
Well, good morning. I'm delighted to be with you.
And you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266, or you can comment on our website, WNPR.org. Polly, in polyphonic.org, you reflected on 14 years as vice president for learning and leadership development at the League of the American Orchestra. Now that you have the chance to step back to be a musician again, do you have some new perspective on the future of symphony orchestras?
Well, thank you for that question, Ray. And what you're referring to is that after having a rich career on the administrative and leadership side of orchestras, I have reconnected after a 32-year hiatus in playing the cello again. And so I'm having the joyful and challenging experience of working at the never-ending challenge of becoming better as a musician and engaging with the rich musical literature that is out there. So it is a lovely moment of coming together as somebody both on the administrative and on the artistic side for whom music is so important.
So you held the feet of Pablo Casals and now you're a cello player. Well, since you've taken up the cello again, one thing you write about is that you've become aware of this disconnect between the musician and the audience. Maybe you can flesh that out a little bit.
Well, sure. And I think, Ray, that it's part of this whole reimagining process and rediscovery process that our industry is in right now. That essentially, I think that music, the music that orchestras play, the orchestras themselves, we are a service to our community. The resource that we have are our wonderful musicians and the music that they make. And heightening the relationship between audience and musician and through them to the music, I think, is part of this process of reinvention that you've been talking about this morning. Those of us who adore music also adore musicians, and we want to feel that we're connected at a performance with their passion for music making and their drive for excellence, and that we as audience members are an important part of that process as well. And I think that looking for that intimacy of relationship, if you will, whether it's at a traditional concert venue and concert performance, or it's in the expanding community roles that orchestra musicians are playing, is something that we seek, and that those of us that support orchestras really, really want in a relationship with these organizations.
Polly, are there symphony orchestras that are doing a great job of this? And maybe you can give some examples of how a symphony can kind of reach out to a community and really kind of be a force in a town or city.
Well, sure, Ray. I think that it is a particularly rich time for this process, I would say, of exponential growth in how we look at orchestras and how we define them in the community. So increasingly, our communities are saying all of the entities in our community, whether they are libraries or WISE or any of the other service organizations, if you will, in community, how are you responding to the reality of our community today and the needs of our community today? And in orchestras, we're seeing the response across a big range. Traditionally, our contribution has been in supporting in-school music education, so extending the vital work of licensed music teachers through the resources that orchestras can bring through youth concerts and in-school programs and family concerts. That's been our traditional role. Now that's extending with after-school work, and perhaps you've heard of some of the work inspired by the El Sistema movement, which is a movement that aligns goals around social justice and music for children and families in poverty. That's programs are growing, I think, in more than 100 orchestras at this point. Health and wellness is another tremendous area of growth, where the research that shows the benefits of music, whether it's for babies and families in neonatal units, whether it's for end-of-life care, for everything in between, that bringing music to people in health and wellness settings, and in a way, when you were referring to my own cello playing, being engaged with a huge number of people that are re-engaging as on an avocational level as adults with music, is a huge area of growth. Another area that is emerging, Ray, is in aligning music in the criminal justice system. And we're seeing some orchestras. We're also seeing Carnegie Hall take a huge lead in the use of music to provide other options for particularly young people who are incarcerated. So I'm happy to give some examples of specific programs in orchestras, but that perhaps paints a picture of where this work is growing and where orchestras and their musicians are engaging.
Right. Polly, when we talk about, you know, getting orchestras out and doing this type of work, I would imagine there's a certain amount of buy-in that that the musicians have to take care of. And, I mean, let's face it, you know, musicians go to conservatory. They might not be prepared to take on something like going out to a prison or, you know, even going into the schools. They say that's not part of what I you know, kind of signed up for. First, let's get some reaction from the musicians here. Would that be something that would the musicians would be willing to do?
I must say that because of Polly's most recent article in Symphony Magazine, I'm currently doing a spotlight on the Central Ohio Symphony, which is a tiny little orchestra, and they're the ones who do drum circles in the prison systems in Ohio. I interviewed one of the percussionists that does this, and she said it's the most fulfilling thing she's ever done in her life.
Yeah. As a member of the Hartford Symphony Orchestra, I have played in a prison. I have played in a mentally deranged. I don't know how to say it politically, but for people who had issues, as well as school programs. So we've done it, and we've done all sorts of things, and we're prepared to do all sorts of things.
Yeah, Stephen.
Yes,
and, Ray. I think your point is a tremendous one, and very important, and it certainly is a moment of challenge for all of us. As the communities are asking for us to be ever more responsive to needs in the community, and we as musicians and as orchestras are trying to be ever more responsive to those needs, different skills are required of us. And it is a challenge because you're absolutely right. Our conservatory education, and it is changing. It definitely is dramatically different today than it was decades ago. But primarily, musicians are drawn to conservatory education because they are so gifted at playing their instrument, and for the most part, conservatory education continues to hone that tremendous gift. And bringing that resource of music making to these other settings requires different skills for sure.
Yeah.
And so part of this period of change that we're in is all of us becoming more comfortable with the notion that we bring our great music making plus, and
right.
other skills may be required, and therefore some training may be required.
Right.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, Polly. We have to cut this a little short, and I do thank you so much for your perspective here. With just a few moments left, Michael, I want to give you the last word here. What's looking ahead for you?
Well, you know, we've seen increased salaries, benefits for administrative staff. The HSO is going to be hiring an assistant conductor despite proposing fewer concerts. They've signed the music director, Carolyn Kwan, to a 6-year contract, and we're very pleased with that, as is the public.
Yep.
The orchestra's on an upswing under Carolyn. And so we need to be able to attract and maintain the caliber of musicians that the HSO is known for. The musicians are the product. An investment in the musicians, a commitment to the product, are essential to the artistic well-being of the Hartford Symphony Orchestra.
Okay. And real quick, you've got a rally coming up on September 9th.
Yes, September 9th at noontime, Wednesday, September 9th at noontime on the north steps of the Capitol. Follow us on Facebook, Musicians of the Hartford Symphony Orchestra, or on Twitter, Musicians of the HSO, at Musicians HSO, or write to David Fay or Jeff Verney at 166 Capitol Ave, Hartford 06106.
All right. Thank you so much. Thanks to our guest, Ann Majette from The Washington Post, our HSO musicians, Michael Pollard, Stephen Wade, and Ann Drinan. Thank you for your perspective, and thanks to Polycon from PK Art Solutions and PK Orchestra Solutions. Our show is produced by Lydia Brown, Tucker Ives, Betsy Kaplan, and Josh Nalaya. Our technical producer is Kyone Wolf. WNPR's digital editor is Heather Brandon. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. You can continue the conversation on our website, WNPR.org, Where We Live. I'm Ray Hardman, and this is Where We Live.